The headlines this hour: Russia says the West's supply of weapons and mercenaries to Ukraine would lead to a global collapse. Israeli forces blow up two Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Also ahead, Syria says the United Nations needs to avoid double standards in its response to Israel's acts of aggression. Thanks for joining us. Russia and Ukraine trade blames over the evacuation of civilians as the conflict between the two countries is about to enter its third week. Addressing a Security Council meeting, Ukraine's UN ambassador accused Russia of violating the two countries' earlier agreements on humanitarian corridors. Sergei Kislytsia said Moscow insists that all passages for the evacuation of civilians must go through Russia and Belarus. He also accused Russia of shelling evacuees and the routes allocated for the corridors. But the Russian envoy denied the accusation. Vasilya Nebenzia said representatives from the Red Cross were invited to the corridors at the request of Ukraine to ensure the safety of the evacuees. Nebenzia blamed Ukrainian nationalists for breaching the agreements on the evacuation process.
The radicals in Mariupol violated this agreement, as is clear from a radio conversation that was intercepted between two commanders of the Nationalist Battalion Azov, that is in Volnovakhi. The radicals there were told to shoot at the legs of those who were heading for the humanitarian corridors. Those who risked life and limb to try and leave Mariupol, when they reached the checkpoints to exit the city, were shot on sight by Ukrainian Nazis. There's a great deal of video evidence of this.
The Russian envoy accused Ukrainian nationalists of using civilians as human shields. He said that they hold thousands of civilians, including foreigners, hostage. Meanwhile, the UN aid chief has called on all parties to allow safe passage for civilians in Ukraine to leave areas of active hostilities in the direction they choose. According to the UN, more than 1.7 million Ukrainians have crossed into Central Europe. The UN has also confirmed the deaths of around 400 civilians in Ukraine since the beginning of Russia's military operation. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, says right-wing militias are to blame for the failure of plans to evacuate citizens from war zones.
Right-wing militias and these Nazi elements that are now running to the cities to gain cover and exploiting the civilians and using them as human shields is an indication of the desperation of Zelensky's forces, and also a revelation of the darkest impulses behind the true nature of their regime, their character. They're not at all interested in the benefit of the Ukrainian people. They're not at all interested in the preservation of Ukrainian culture. They're about war and doing the bidding of their puppet masters, which is primarily the United States. So they've been pushed into this, resist at all costs, cause maximum damage, sabotage your own nuclear fields, blame it on the Russians, set off your own power outages, destroy your own water sources, and blame it on the Russians in a massive propaganda war. But I think the Russians are doing the opposite. They're winning the hearts and minds of the local people by providing safety, providing corridors for humanitarian aid, providing exit points for those who want to get out of the way, and Russia is going to focus on the annihilation of the right-wing Nazi militia groups, and I think this will be all over in a matter of days.
Russia's military offensive against Ukraine and the ensuing Western sanctions are wreaking havoc on global markets and the global economy, with Moscow warning of unpredictable and catastrophic consequences. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. On Nord Stream 2 sanctions, Novak warned that Russia could cut gas supplies via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany, but it has not made such a decision yet. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Together with Ukraine, it accounts for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market. Pakistan has resisted the pressure of the West, particularly the European countries, to condemn Russia over its attack on Ukraine. Islamabad also reacted sharply to the unusual move by the Western diplomatic missions using social media platforms to put pressure on Pakistan. Kamran Youssef has the details.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the US embassy in Islamabad. The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols. On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? Are we your slaves? That whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
But the only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Iran sending a new military satellite into space with a launch being described as successful. The announcement was made by the Aerospace Division of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The satellite, dubbed Nur 2, was launched out of a location in Shahrud Desert and placed into orbit some 500 kilometers above Earth. The IRGC says the satellite will be used for reconnaissance purposes. The IRGC's first space launch took place in April 2020, when it put Nur 1 satellite into orbit. The IRGC says Nur 1 is still active, despite predictions of a one-year lifespan, and continues to send signals. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that his country opposes both war and sanctions. He made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, which touched upon the conflict in Ukraine. Amir Abdollahian said Tehran's cooperation with any country, including Russia, should not be affected by sanctions. For his part, Lavrov slammed the sanctions imposed on his country and stressed the need for closer cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Separately, Amir Abdollahian had a phone call with his Turkish counterpart. He told Mevlut Çavuşoğlu that Tehran supports efforts to find a political solution for the Ukraine conflict and stands ready to lend a helping hand. Çavuşoğlu said that he will participate in a joint meeting with his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts to facilitate a ceasefire. He said it is highly important to try to ease tensions in Ukraine, as the conflict could lead to humanitarian catastrophe. Happening this morning near the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces set about their routine demolition project. They have blown up two more Palestinian homes. They used explosives to blow up the buildings that belonged to two Palestinian prisoners. The regime accuses the duo of killing an Israeli settler last year. Israel defends the practice of raising the family homes of attackers as a deterrent against future assaults. But rights groups have condemned the tactic as collective punishment. Last year, Israeli demolitions and seizures of Palestinian structures across the occupied West Bank increased by 32%. Over 650 Palestinians were displaced as a result. more than half of them children. To get the details about the latest Israeli demolitions, we have reached out to our correspondent Mona Kandil. Let's have a listen to what she said.
This demolition had taken place as a punitive measure or a collective punishment, because at the time those who carried out the operation, according to the Israelis, were arrested. However, their family homes had been destroyed in order to terrify and to send a clear message to other Palestinians not to follow the footsteps of Palestinian activists or Palestinian heroes, as they are described by Palestinians here in the occupied West Bank. Of course, the demolition was not easy, because Palestinians in Sidat al-Harifiya had clashed with Israeli forces, and many were wounded, according to our sources in Sidat al-Harifiya and Jenin.
Syria says the latest Israeli act of aggression and Daesh terrorist attack, coming in quick succession, illustrates clear and direct coordination between the two entities. The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned about the repercussions of Israel's repeated attacks. It said the raids inflict heavy material and human losses, besides causing fear among the civilian population, especially women and children. The ministry called on the UN and the UN Security Council to fulfill their responsibility and avoid double standards in responding to such, quote, seriously risky actions. Israel's Monday airstrikes near the Syrian capital Damascus killed two civilians. One day earlier, over a dozen Syrian army forces were killed in a Daesh terrorist attack in the central province of Homs. The Yemeni army says it has shot down American-made reconnaissance aircraft over the northwestern province of Hajjah. The army says the Scan Eagle drone was intercepted while carrying out a hostile operation. Yemeni armed forces frequently down American-made drones operated by Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the Yemeni airspace. Saudi Arabia and its allies have also recently intensified their airstrikes on Yemen. Their targets are mostly civilian infrastructure. Since 2015, the Saudi-led military campaign has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and has pushed millions towards poverty and famine. Venezuela's president confirms he's had a meeting with a high-level U.S. delegation visiting Caracas, what appears to be a U-turn in Washington's hostile policy towards the Latin American state. Nicolas Maduro said the meeting was, in his own words, respectful, cordial, and very diplomatic, and that the two sides agreed on an agenda for future discussions. Earlier, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the trip focused on a number of issues, including energy security. Media are quoting informed sources as saying that the talks focused on the easing of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela's oil. The U.S. is looking to use Venezuela's huge energy reserves amid the Western pressure campaign against Russia over its Ukraine offensive. Maduro has openly supported Russia's military move. The relations between Washington and Caracas have been sour. The White House cut off diplomatic relations in the year 2019. One teenager is killed and two others critically injured in a shooting outside of a high school in the U.S. state of Iowa. The incident happened in the state capital, Des Moines, shortly before 3 p.m. local time. A police statement says the gunfire appears to have come from a passing vehicle. Three potential suspects have been detained, but no charges have been filed. Mass killings involving firearms are common in the U.S., with the number of victims on the rise. Over 80 mass shootings have already been recorded this year, with the total number of gun violence deaths standing at nearly 8,000. The majority of Americans favor greater gun controls. However, lax laws and the right to bear arms have hampered efforts to clamp down on the number of weapons in circulation. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist. He has shared with us his view of why shootings are still a major issue in the U.S.
This is a long and sad story. This recent shooting, it's tragic, as they all are, and we will soon hear the elected officials offering their thoughts and prayers to the victims. Thoughts and prayers are not enough. They need to legislate to get the guns out of the hands of so many people. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court always says that, or has stated repeatedly, that the right to bear arms trumps everything else. They forget that the right to bear arms was written into law when the U.S. had a standing militia, was It didn't have a regular army as it has today. But the National Rifle Association, which is the biggest pro-gun lobby in the United States, has been very powerful for years. That power is diminishing now, but it has been very powerful for years and has invoked a thought in people's minds that owning guns is important and is necessary, and that any attempt to restrict gun ownership at all is a major infringement on their rights. This is simply not true. It's a myth, but many people have come to believe it, and that's why we have the problems that the United States has today.
The U.S. intelligence assessment indicates that North Korea's recent missile launches could be the groundwork for a return to intercontinental ballistic missile and nuclear bomb tests for the first time in nearly 5 years. The U.S. Directorate of National Intelligence says commercial satellite imagery shows construction at North Korea's nuclear testing site that was closed in 2018. International experts also say the North's main nuclear reactor facility is in full swing, potentially creating additional fuel for nuclear weapons. North Korea tested a record number of missiles in January as part of a program to modernize its arsenal. Pyongyang insists that such tests are meant to strengthen its defense power in the face of Washington's hostile policies, sanctions, and joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the account of Imam Khomeini's proposal for marriage to Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. If you remember, it was said that there was opposition toward this marriage, as the girl was from a rich family and might not tolerate tough conditions of a clergyman like young Sayyid Ruhullah, who had little material facilities and was seriously engaged in a struggle against the puppet tyrannical regime. Today you will hear more on the issue. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
Lady Khadija Saghafi's father raised several conditions for her daughter's marriage with Imam Khomeini. Firstly, he had not married before. Secondly, he had no children. Thirdly, he should be rich enough to administer an ordinary family. Fourthly, he should not transfer his wife's house to Khomeini. Mr. Lavasani informed Sayyid Ruhullah of the conditions, and the latter accepted all of them. Thus, Khadija's father took a handwritten promise from Imam Khomeini not to change the daughter's residence. The young couple resided in a small house in Tehran. They stayed in this house for a few months as Sayyid Ruhullah decided to go to Qom to attend the courses in the seminary of that city. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the story as follows. A few months had passed since our marriage. It was the Nowruz of 1309. The house rent had expired and spring was near. The classes were going to begin in Qom. The groom, this diligent student, was very enthusiastic. He was just thinking of Qom. In other words, he was preparing me to leave for Qom. He was eager to go while I was not. He would insist and I would keep silent. I knew that there was no escape and we should go, but I could not give up soon. It was hard for him to stay while for me it seemed impossible to leave as I didn't like Qom for living with a person whom I had not got used to yet. I was very scared. Imam Khomeini's wife continues her account on leaving Tehran for Qom. I had accepted to leave with Mr. Ruhullah. Now, against my will, I had to leave Tehran, my parents, sisters, and brothers, who all live there. I had to leave everyone for a place where I would be lonely. But accompanying the husband is a principle, and I had to live up to the determinations which God has set and I have accepted. I should accept them with satisfaction as it determines my happiness in this world and the hereafter. The Quran says it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you, and it may be that you love something while it is bad for you. Therefore, young Khadija set out for Qom, although she knew that life in that city would surely include many problems. Lady Masume, peace upon her, was her only companion in that lonely city, as she says. Till the end of staying in Qom, whenever I was upset or sad, I would go to Lady Masume's shrine. I would cry there and clean my eyes. Then I would return home with a happy heart and joyous face. After all, I had made the decision when I wanted to come to Qom, as I had no one other than Lady Masume to confide with. Imam Khomeini and his wife left Tehran for Qom on Farvardin 14th, 1309, corresponding with April 3rd, 1930. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the account. Finally, we were to set out. The truck was hired, and it was the first time that I was traveling in such a vehicle. My dowry was loaded on the trunk and we were placed on narrow seats. Some others also got on the truck. I was crying right till Hassanabad. After nearly 3 hours of crying, Mr. Ruhullah said, "That's enough. Have patience." I was silent and choked my feeling, which caused me sore throat. The young couple rented a small house after 1 week of staying at a friend's home. Khadija soon made friend with the wife of the owner. She says, In my first letter to my mother, I wrote that, in spite of being lonely, I have found a good friend, and Mr. Ruhollah has rented a nice house which has 14 fruits. Do not be sad for me. Imam Khomeini's first child, Mustafa, was born in this house, only to decrease his mother's loneliness. Imam Khomeini's third residence was located in an old neighborhood in Qom. The rental was hard for the couple to pay, as young Ruhollah wouldn't like to receive the stipend from the sources of emulation and had made himself content with the income that he would get sporadically from his paternal real estate in Khomeini. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the story. The rental was a little high for my husband. We led a life of a seminary student in or a small house. Mr. Ruhollah had a small real estate in Khomeini, which we tried to make ourselves content with that, not to show our need. He would never accept any stipend and was very magnanimous. However, the revenues of the real estate were not regular for us to rely on. We had to live in tough conditions for 6 months so that the wheat in Khomeini was sold to get our share to pay the debts. Yet, Mr. Ruhollah preferred hunger for his child rather than accepting the stipend, although other ulama and students would receive it. He was very knowledgeable, and the sources of emulation were ready to pay him other amounts of money, but he would never accept. He let us taste hardships to taste freedom. I tolerated patiently so that he remains Haj Agha Ruhollah. At last, I brought those hardships to their knees. Dear listeners, the revenues of Imam Khomeini would receive little of his father's real estates and farms in Khomeini. But this does not mean that he had a poor family. His father was a very generous man who used to spend great parts of his revenues to the poor and the needy. The family would feed hundreds of people during wars and famines. He had a lot of properties, farms and gardens in the villages around Khomeini, but he used to spend the revenues mostly for charity and religious schools. Lady Khadija Saghafi recommends the young generation try to live simply, try to be content, try not to be indebted to anyone for a better and wealthier life. If a person wants to live with dignity and pride, he or she should heed lest the luxuries of this world may not deceive him or her.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavit Atway. The Russian military operation against Ukraine is taking its toll, both on the Russian and also on the Ukrainian side. But there is another toll taking place, and that is the economic toll. There are no ambiguities about how the avalanche of sanctions against Russia is destroying the Russian economy. But what about the economy of European countries, or the U.S. for that matter? How about the rest of the world? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the economic warfare against Russia
will make or break Russia first, or Europe and the U.S. perhaps, a gamble with the economic brunt ultimately falling on the ordinary people.
Since Russia attacked Ukraine on February 24th, Western countries have resorted to a host of restrictive economic measures to hinder Russia's ability to finance its military offensive in Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe, in particular, have imposed what they call unprecedented sanctions on Russia. They have frozen the assets of Russia's central bank, limiting its ability to access $630 billion of reserves. Likewise, planned investments in Russia have been restricted as a result of imposing capital controls. Moreover, several Russian banks have been removed from the SWIFT payment system to further isolate the country from the global financial system.
The sanctions has been triggered by the war, and the purpose is to weaken the Russian economy.
The sanctions have led to a sharp devaluation of the Russian currency, the ruble, and pushing up the inflation. The crushing ruble is creating growing panic among Russian citizens and increasing the inflation. Europe is under pressure to broaden sanctions by targeting Russia's energy sector, but the continent imports about 25% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia, and the huge energy reliance has turned out to be a stumbling block. Gas prices in Europe soared to record highs on Monday on supply fears, reaching over $3,900 per 1,000 cubic meters for the first time in history. Sanctions on Russia are expected to further increase oil and gas prices, which will fuel inflation and intensify an already acute squeeze on living standards in Europe. Ending the war in Ukraine through pressurizing Putin is a priority for European leaders, but for now, they are weighing up how much pain they are prepared to inflict on their own people. Russia's economy is integrated into the global economy, and that means sanctions will hurt not only Russia, but the countries that impose such penalties. Sanctions are generally meant to bring about a policy shift or a change of leadership, but experience shows they fail to achieve those goals, despite bringing a lot of pain to the civilian populations. Whether Russia's efforts in the past years to make its economy sanctions-proof will pay off, or how the country will survive the tough sanctions regime it's facing, is anyone's guess. But the main question is, if the Western countries are prepared to go all the way and sanction Russian energy exports altogether.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is John Ross. He's a senior fellow at the Chung Yang Institute for Financial Studies, who joins us from London. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Ross, I'm going to start with you. It must have looked very simple in some ways for the Russian President Vladimir Putin to have executed this military operation, given the military superiority of Russia, and the Kremlin perhaps thinking that this operation is going to take a limited number of days, perhaps, or a short period of time. But at this point, we're looking at a gamble that Russia was hoping that if the duration was going to take a little bit long, that it could draw upon its war chest of about $630 billion. We can see that that has not transpired. Do you think that the Russian strategy in terms of its support is something that was either underestimated or not thoroughly thought through by the Russian president?
No, I think that the estimate of the situation in Russia is very simple. Russia was facing a deadly threat to itself. The incorporation of Ukraine into NATO would place NATO missiles, including nuclear missiles, about 5 minutes flying time from Moscow. And Russia made clear it was not prepared to accept this under any circumstances, in exactly the same way that the US, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, was prepared, if necessary, to go to nuclear war in order to prevent there being Soviet missiles within a few minutes flying time to Washington. That was the position of the United Russia in this situation, the same as the US, and it struck against that. Then people totally misunderstand the history of Russia. Russia has been attacked four times. This is the fourth attack on Russia in the last two centuries, mm-hmm. from the West, but from Napoleon in 1812, the Whites in 1918, the Hitler in 1941, and each time Russia has defended itself and defeated the people who attack it. If you think it's going to be put off by the fact that Russian banks are taken out of SWIFT, or the Russian people are not capable of suffering that, they completely misunderstand Russian history.
Okay, we need to, but the history is not, Paolo Rofone, what is transpiring right now, today, looking at the different tools that Russia has in terms of trying to sustain sanctions. I talked about the war chest. I'd like to find out from you how Russia is estimating or forecasting at this point, from this point forward, how it's going to be able to maintain its military operation. Obviously, the sanction onslaught, which we're going to get into, is so severe. One of the consequences has been Russia's accessibility to its funds, which at this point, at least $460 billion worth, it can't access. No, this is for Paolo Rofone. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paolo Rofone.
Yeah, evidently these the sanctions are unprecedented, also because they are targeting the central bank, which is one of the key organs of the identity of the state. So they are really unprecedented. So far, these kind of actions called sanctions were targeting commercial interests or individuals specifically. This time, they have been a leap forward. I do not see much of a problem for Russia because finally the reserves that Russia has, also in terms of gold and other assets, are sufficient to sustain the needs of Russia, even in the military endeavor that is carrying out. Mm-hmm. So there will be some problems, as we already know. There are some problems in the adjustment from an open world to a closed world, but they will keep going.
All right. Well, let's keep going and look at the broader world and look at the impacts that this has had, John Ross. The price of oil, it hit $140 a barrel. I mean, these are prices we haven't seen since the year 2008. We're looking at countries that are suffering from it, really worldwide. But in particular, in this case in point, we could talk about the U.S., or you can talk about the U.S. and also Europe, in terms of how it's impacting those economies. And we talked a little bit about the Russian perspective, but is this something that you think the Europeans and the U.S., which in some ways are leading perhaps this whole sanctions, did think that through? Was it in their calculations that oil would get to this price? And then what about a strategy for substituting it, which, again, we'll talk a little later as to some of the different routes they have taken?
No, I think they probably didn't calculate it would go to this price. I mean, I think it's destroyed the Biden presidency. I mean, he's already got inflation problems in the United States, and with the price of oil, I think he's finished. And therefore, the aggressive policy which the United States has carried out against Russia, because that's what's involved, the situation was totally clear. Russia was perfectly prepared to accept for Ukraine to be neutral. It was not prepared to accept for Ukraine to be part of NATO. Biden insisted on going ahead with the policy of NATO. He's now produced a war. He's produced a gigantic oil price. And he will lose the presidency as a result of this. So he's done himself in. Similarly, prospects will unroll themselves in Europe. But in the United States, it's totally clear. that Biden has committed suicide by this aggression.
Some say, according to some polls, one poll, that Biden's presidency is going to be defined by this Ukraine war. Well, John Ross, Paolo Raffone, the U.S. Is suffering from economic fallout from this because we know that Russia is actually the third country on the list of the U.S. when it imports oil. Of course, we're looking at Europe also suffering from this. The price of oil has led, well, hasn't led. There was inflation, and now this is adding to the rise of inflation, which is at record levels, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe. So these shockwaves, is it sustainable for the U.S. and for Europe, let alone the rest of the world? For how long you think that this course can continue?
For Europe, it will be very... Hello?
Yes, you're still there.
For Europe, there will be a serious problem very soon because the shortages, not only in energy supply, will hamper the small economic restart after the pandemic. So the situation will be, from a socioeconomic point of view, extremely tense, if not dangerous. And we will see it in the coming 3 months or so, because data that are coming in that basically with the level of prices of today, most people will have just to either not heat themselves or stop their activities. So this is a situation that will backslash on Europe. And the awkward attempt to make the deal so that Iran could trade its oil because of the nuclear agreement is apparently in jeopardy at the moment, because the Americans have been pushing to a level that finally even the export of enriched uranium to Russia is not possible. So this is a sort of a cage-22 situation. Europe will have to rethink this aggressive sanctioning policy that has adopted.
Well, I'm not too sure if Europe is rethinking that, John Ross, when you're looking at, for example, how European gas prices are trading at what MarketWatch said is equivalent of over $500 per barrel. You're in London. This is what's amazing, where bills are set, electric bills, energy bills, are set to hit £3,000 this year. That means 40 million UK citizens are heading for fuel poverty. So when our guest Paolo Raffone talks about Europe needs to think this through, well, people are going to, they don't have enough money to heat their homes. And we know in the UK, people die as a result of not being able to afford their electric bills or their gas or energy bills. Is this something the UK is taking into consideration?
No, but I think it will result in the fall of a large number of European governments, West European governments, because they've embarked on a policy which is deeply damaging to their population. And in the contrast in Russia is that people will rally behind the government, because you don't understand Russian history. Russia, to defeat Hitler, suffered 27 million people dead. Undoubtedly, the Russian population will suffer as a result of the sanctions. But they're not, you know, it's nothing. I won't say it's trivial, but it's nothing compared to what Russia has been through in its history. Therefore, they will rally behind what the government is doing. Whereas in Western Europe, I would say because of the result of the inflation, a large number of Western European governments will fall. And as I said, the Biden administration has committed suicide.
Okay. It's interesting. Paolo Raffone, what we're trying to do here is look at the Russian perspective and then look at the perspective from the Europeans and the U.S. And maybe we could put the rest of the world somewhat in that, minus obviously Russia's allies. It seems that the perspective from the European and the U.S. side is putting aside the interests of the people. And they're solely going after Putin. They want to bring Putin to its knees. The desire seems to be portrayed as such. Do you think that motivation is costing the Europeans and even the U.S. the well-being of their own citizens as a result of their sanctions regime?
Definitely it is, and it should be understood. So we are trying to understand who does what and why. So from the U.S. perspective, the challenge through military means that Russia has made is intolerable for the fact that it is putting an end to the hegemony that the United States have had since the end of Second World War in Europe, in the way that we have seen unfolded, especially in the past two or three decades. So this is something that for the United States sent all the strategists ballistic. And so they have now put in place this incredibly nonsensical aggression to a single person, which is Putin, and trying to unite the ranks in the West against this enemy that has been identified. Well, this is working in the short time now, but we have to see already in the medium time what will happen. And I doubt that democratic governments, which are inelastic to restrictions and shortages, will support this kind of policy.
Okay. Let's move on to another aspect of this, if we can, John Ross, and talk about the dollar, in which the U.S. has been very fond of using it in many different ways, and one in its foreign policy by weaponizing the effect and the use of the dollar. It's one of the tools in the U.S.'s toolbox. It seems to think that it could do that when it comes to Russia, through the sanctions policy especially. But many analysts are concluding that this may backfire, that the dollar is going to get threatened. One way that it's going to get threatened, and I'd like to ask from you, is how Russia has de-dollarized its economy for quite some time. And you add to that, for example, a major ally like China, who's been doing the same, not to mention Iran, who is also on that path. Do you think the dollar will be threatened as a result of the Ukrainian conflict and how it's progressing in that direction more and more?
Well, the position of the dollar will be weakened, but the dollar remains one of the strongest aspects of the United States. I do not anticipate that the dollar will collapse as the main means of international payments in the coming period, and therefore this will create problems for Russia. Russia and China and Iran and other countries have definitely been attempting to de-dollarize, but this is a very difficult process which will take maybe 10 or 20 years. So my estimate would be that the sanctions, including the dollar, will impose pain on the Russian population. I don't want to pretend that they won't, but the Russian population, because they conceive that they're defending their country, will be prepared to withstand this pain much more than the governments in the United States or Western Europe are capable of withstanding that pain. So I would like to say that the dollar will disappear, you know, as a international currency, you know, in the next 5 years, but I don't honestly believe it.
Well, this one particular viewer seems to think otherwise, Paolo Raffone, and I'm going to read off what he has posted. The decision to push almost 3 billion people from Russia, India, and China into trading with each other in currencies other than the dollar will go down as one of the most short-sighted and self-destructive policies in U.S. history. Do you agree?
To a certain extent, yes. It is evident that the building of this wall of sanctions and threats of military interventions, let's also think to Taiwan, it's something that is strengthening the links between all the rest of the world out of the West. So this is also something that we have seen despite the majority vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations. The declarations of the single governments before the vote they were quite interesting. I mean, they condemned the use of force, of course, because we are in the UN and it is the charter demanding it. But at the same time, there were a lot of nuances. So continuing this aggressive approach may risk to shift the majority of people who voted in the UN towards a new majority, which says we have enough of this aggressiveness of the United States, its dollar and its guns. So this may happen. And it is a gamble. We have to see what will be the evolution in the next days or weeks of the current warfare in Europe.
Okay. Well, since I'm looking at the clock, we really don't have that much time here. You've mentioned, John Ross, a number of times Russia's history here. And I'd like to also point out how the Russian President Vladimir Putin on many occasions has said that these nationalists or far-right Nazis, as he's called them, are using people as human shields. The history check that you gave us, the statements from Vladimir Putin, none of this is truly reflected in the media. Why is it that that side, the Russian side, is being neglected, at least to show, and I'm not promoting the civilian casualties caused as a result of this war, nor promoting war. Why isn't that side being, or that narrative at least, being covered in the way that it should?
Well, because the West has been carried on for 30 years a policy of aggression against Russia, that's the United States. The United States pretended that its only opposition to Russia was over communism, but once communism collapsed in 1991, the United States continued its aggression against Russia. So that shows that what the US policy was a total lie. So if you have 30 years of aggression against Russia, the truth of the situation is going to be concealed at the present time, and that's exactly what's happening.
30 seconds, Paolo Raffone. The threat of a third world war, nuclear proliferation, economic recessions possibly, in U.S. maybe, and Europe, and not to mention other parts of the world, the civilian casualties that have happened. Is that all worth it based on what has happened? Based on how...
This is really tragic what we are witnessing. I mean, it's something that wiser people like Kissinger or Kennan, who certainly knew the situation, they've been warning about in 2014 and after that. And the leaderships that have been coming to the United States, unfortunately, do not seem up to the task and have the knowledge enough to handle a situation which is dangerous if they push it too far.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Paolo Raffone there, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation for Brussels. Thank you for your input. And thank you for your analysis, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Newsroom at pressfree.ir. Any questions or comments, that's our email address. You can send it to us. From Mikome Tagwe, entire team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. Today, inshallah, we shall be discussing about the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam at the end of the time, or akhir al-zaman. For that, we have again invited a respected scholar, guest of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary School. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. It's a great pleasure for us to have you here. Dear Sheikh, it has been asked that at the narrations known or famous as the narrations of Akhir al-Zaman or apocalyptic narrations, it has been said and mentioned that there is a sort of white death at the end of that time. It has been asked that can we adapt these series of narration with what is actually we are afflicted with in these days, that is the pandemic due to coronavirus. Can we say that this might be a sign of that great event that, inshallah, will definitely happen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Very valid question about the end of time. It is one of the questions has been frequently has been asked about the end of time. And many people ask such a question about the signs for the end of time.
Yeah.
You see that this narration, this particular narration has been quoted in Al-Kharaij wal-Jara'ih by Qutbuddin Rawandi, who passed away in 573. One of the prominent Shia scholars, he has compiled many books, one of which is, as I mentioned, Al-Kharaij wal-Jara'ih. He has quoted this narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, first Shia Imam. He said that Bayna yaday al-qa'im mawtu ahmar wa mawtu abyaz. Before the appearance of Imam Mahdi, the last savior of humanity, we have some signs.
Yeah.
Some of the signs are, for example, in this way, mawtu ahmar, you know, red death,
yeah.
And then we have white death.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I just want to skip some part of the narration. Imam said, وَأَمَّا الْمَوْتُ الْأَحْمَرُ فَبِالسَّيْفِ. Red death referring to the sword.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe Imam wanted to indicate to the war battles between different groups. And of course, it has its own explanation. And then Imam said that, وَأَمَّا الْمَوْتُ الْأَبْيَضُ فَالطَّاعُونَ. But the white death is plague, you know, the kind of disease that maybe it has its you know, character. But you know, in our narration, it has been mentioned that it is white death.
True.
Because of maybe some particular, you know, character that it has.
True.
But after all, you know, in this narration, we do not want to go to the chain of the narration, whether there is authentic one or not. Just we want to ignore the chain of the narration.
Yeah.
But after all, this narration referring to the some signs for the appearance of Imam al-Mahdi, last savior of humanity. You know, in this narration, Imam referring to the two kinds of the signs and death. You know, before the appearance of Imam Mahdi, one of which is red one,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the second is white.
Very true.
This white that we are talking about and that we are, you know, dealing with is kind of, as Imam mentioned it explicitly, is ta'un.
So can it this pandemic be called a ta'un as well, be called a plague? Because, you know, ta'un is not necessarily a certain kind of disease, if I'm not mistaken. It can be even applied to different types of diseases.
If, you know, if even if it's referred to different kind of disease, we cannot adapt it and we cannot compare it to the, for example, coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this adaptation, or I want to say that we cannot impose our understanding to the what's to the you know, events which are occurring in this world.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot do that. Okay.
True.